hay sanción, no hay amenaza que hoy por hoy le haga daño al esfuerzo de construir un nuevo modelo económico productivo.
This month, after a brief reprieve, the U.S. government announced its decision to reintroduce wide-reaching economic coercive measures against Venezuela's oil industry. The White House claims that this snapback of sanctions is due to the non-compliance by the Nicolas Maduro government with the October 2023 Barbados Agreement signed with the U.S.-backed opposition. Ultimately, Washington returned to a harsh sanctions policy over Maria Corina Machado's political ban. U.S. officials even reportedly met Venezuelan counterparts recently, but could not force concessions from Caracas to allow for her inclusion on the ballot. And rightly so. It is not up to the U.S. to decide if Machado should be allowed to seek the presidency. That is a decision that should only be made by Venezuela's institutions. It is worth remembering that the far-right candidate saw her ban upheld by the Venezuelan Supreme Court, which pointed to her corrupt dealings and support for U.S.-led coercive measures as justification. Machado was betting on the U.S. forcing Venezuela to include her. It didn't pay off. But now Venezuelans must decide what happens next. Will the socialist government continue to accommodate the interests of capital in order to survive the U.S.-led economic war? Perhaps instead the organized masses will be able to reverse this trend and instead build more socialism. It's food for thought. Welcome to the Venezuela Analysis Podcast. I'm your host, José Luis Granado Ceja. The Venezuela Analysis Podcast brings you independent, on-the-ground, English-language coverage of Venezuela and the Bolivarian process. You'll hear news and in-depth analysis about the country, as well as coverage of leftists and grassroots forces. On today's episode, we're talking about the Pueblo a Pueblo initiative, a grassroots plan for organizing the production, distribution, and consumption of food that directly connects agricultural producers with urban dwellers, an effort that aims for communities to take ownership of the productive chains. To talk about this effort, we will speak with Laura Lorenzo, one of the spokespersons for Pueblo a Pueblo. But first, we'll speak with Venezuela Analysis editor Ricardo Vaz about the decision by the Biden administration to once again impose an oil blockade on Venezuela and the decisions that the Venezuelan people must take in the face of renewed imperialist aggression.
Hello, Ricardo. Welcome to the program. It's good to have you. It's been a while, actually, and it's good to be able to have a chance to talk with you about this. We have to address the elephant in the room. As we know, we learned that the U.S. has decided to reimpose its oil blockade on Venezuela, lifting up the temporary suspension of sanctions that was implemented approximately 6 months ago, making the decision to once again impose unilateral coercive measures on Venezuela. And many analysts, including some of our own, even at the Venezuela Analysis website, said that the U.S. was unlikely to take this step, given other pressing factors, primarily the U.S. interest in securing stability in international oil prices, but also the migration issue. So from your point of view, help us unwrap what's going on right now. What's behind this snapback of sanctions on Venezuela's oil industry?
Hey, José Luis, it's great to be back. It's been a while, yeah, it's a few episodes since I last joined you here. So indeed, I mean, in the end, it wasn't a surprise because we had kind of a buildup of, you know, all these anonymous sources telling us that it was likely that the U.S. was going to revoke General License 44. But even then, there was some speculation if it was going to be replaced with something, you know, a bit more restrictive. I remember this article that you wrote when the Washington Post had some speculation that there was going to be some, you know, final restrictions on, you know, how Venezuela could get paid and so on. But in the end, there was nothing of the sort. So the U.S. Treasury Department simply let General License 44 expire and introduced some 45-day grace period for companies to wind down their operations and then request additional licenses if they want to continue dealing with Venezuela beyond the end of May. So I think it responds to a lot of things. I mean, first of all, kind of shows a bit how disoriented the Biden administration is with respect to its Venezuela policy, because Biden has been in office he has nearly completed his term. And we remember that when he took office, there was an immediate admission that, you know, Trump's policy had failed, even from the U.S.'s own interests of, you know, triggering regime change, that Trump's maximum pressure campaign and the interim government nonsense had failed. So they had to try something different. And yet here we are 4 years later. And it's not like this is a return to maximum pressure, but it's, you know, 95% pressure. So it kind of shows that the Biden administration has kind of been stuck in two minds, you know, on one hand, cornered by the hawkish sectors in Washington, D.C. And the Florida electoral calculations and all of that. And also, I mean, unwilling to admit that sanctions do cause a lot of damage to the Venezuelan population. I mean, only when they do show up at the U.S.'s doorstep, so to say, did we start seeing some sort of admission that there was a correlation between the U.S.'s coercive measures against the Venezuelan economy and the migration phenomenon. So I think there are many ways to look at it. I mean, in the short term, the U.S. kind of wants to be seen to be doing something because, it kind of shows how unpredictable things are, because the U.S. isn't, and the Democrats in particular, are not particularly fond of Maria Corina Machado. I mean, she's an extremist. She's really, you talked about stability in the oil markets. She's not really someone who can secure or can ensure stability in any scenario. So if you took a poll in Washington a year ago, I mean, I'm sure they would have chosen somebody else. But such is the dynamics of Venezuelan politics and of the opposition itself. She ended up winning this very shady or dubious primary race. I mean, she won it, but it still had a lot to be said. And so the U.S. was kind of backed into a corner of having to support her, even though she's hardly the ideal candidate for them. And so once she's barred from running, and there are more than enough reasons for her to be barred from running, the U.S. has to be seen to be doing something in this very ludicrous description of freedom and democracy that we always see in U.S. foreign policy. But at the same time, and I don't want to be referring to my own writing here, I wrote a couple of pieces in the past year trying to look at sanctions from a bit further away. So we always get trapped in this kind of short-term vision. You know, Trump imposed sanctions ahead of the Venezuelan 2018 elections to see if there was enough of a squeeze on the Venezuelan population so that they would vote for somebody else. Now we're talking about this electoral calculation and so on. But from afar, we have to keep in mind what are, you know, perhaps the two main goals of the U.S. when it comes to Venezuela, with Venezuela policy. First, there's the, you know, we talked about the elephant in the room. There's this the elephant under the ground, which are these gigantic oil reserves. And of course, the U.S. wants to have access to them. And on the other, perhaps more importantly, but also related, there is this idea and this very real prospect of an alternative model being constructed here. And so that's a very real threat to U.S. interests. And so the two things are connected in the sense that oil revenues are used to fuel, quite literally, this alternative construction. And so the U.S. wants to, you know, achieve these two goals at the same time. So what sanctions do is that they end up limiting Venezuela's sovereignty. So here we're talking about how foreign corporations now need to apply for a license if they want to continue dealing with Venezuela. So this is, in a sense, is Venezuela and whatever foreign partners need to get the U.S.'s approval, so to say, because, you know, these companies do not want to be targeted by secondary sanctions. And so in a way, the deals will have to be done in such a way that they do not carry enough of an advantage for Venezuela for the U.S. to deem it a danger. So it's the scope in which Venezuela can operate is much more limited. And so I think that's the kind of the long-term implications of sanctions, and also why they're not going away. I mean, even though they were ostensibly a regime change tactic, despite all the previous cases where we know they don't work in that specific regard, but they stay in place because they limit Venezuela's ability to exercise its sovereignty, to grow its economy, and also because it allows the U.S. not only to limit what Venezuela can do, but also to choose which corporations get to deal in these very advantageous terms that I was mentioning, which companies get to deal with Venezuela.
Yeah, so in your response, you talk about some of the impacts that invariably these sanctions have on Venezuela. And on today's program, we're talking about grassroots efforts to address food production, distribution, and consumption via organized social production. I think it's one of the features of the Bolivarian process that still speak to that socialist horizon. And so this initiative that we're looking at today, Pueblo a Pueblo, was very much born in response to the economic crisis, one that was prompted by U.S. intervention in Venezuela. And so now it looks like the total elimination of sanctions, which is what the Venezuelan people, the Venezuelan government have been pushing for, that looks like it's off the table. So what impact do you think the current U.S. policy will have on these sorts of grassroots initiatives, right? Like you mentioned in your previous response, you talked about how it limits things. But is there any truth to this notion that a revolution needs a whip of counter-revolution, sort of that discipline that it gives you knowing that this enemy is bearing down upon you in this specific Venezuelan context?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, I'd recommend people look up an episode of this Tatuí TV series called Chavez Radical. And there's an episode when he's actually talking about how the revolution needs the whip of the counter-revolution. I think he's referring to the events in 2002, 2003, you know, the coup attempt, the oil lockout, and how that was a catalyst for the radicalization of the Bolivarian process. When we talk about impact in this grassroots production, we can go to kind of a very specific perspective, which is if there are fuel shortages, these you know, grassroots food distribution initiatives get very, very seriously hurt. I mean, if you talk to Pueblo Pueblo, over, and not just them, I mean, they're not the only initiative, but they're one of the most organized and most interesting, in my opinion, in our opinion. You know, fuel shortages are deadly in that regard. And also because, you know, a scarce commodity also breeds speculation and a black market and all of that, all those things that we know and we have witnessed in Venezuela for the past 5-10 years. So, I mean, there's kind of a material consequence of the hardening of sanctions against Venezuela. We talk about fuel on one hand. We can also talk about, you know, more migration. You know, organizations need cadres, and if they migrate, then, you know, who's there to implement or to build this bottom-up socialist alternatives? So it's a very difficult scenario in many ways. Also, if day-to-day life becomes more precarious, people have less time to work as activists and to do voluntary work, which is what we're talking about when it comes to building these alternatives. So there is that material perspective that's very real, and we should never look past it. But also, there's kind of a broader context, and when we talk about the whip of the counter-revolution, which is we need to stop having illusions about the enemy, right? I mean, we need to stop believing that there will be some kind of modus vivendi where the U.S. is going to stop trying to interfere in Venezuela. Even now, there have certainly been many concessions in the favor of capital, in the favor of foreign capital particularly, but that's never going to be enough for the United States for many reasons. I mean, on one hand, there is still, you know, for all the contradictions that we can discuss, there is still a continuous line between the Chavez government and the present government of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. So there is still a lot of affinity. Much of the discourse is still the same. And on the other hand, you have these grassroots movements who, you know, they have suffered with the crisis, but paradoxically, some of them, the ones that had more political clarity, have actually strengthened and reinvented themselves in these very difficult times. And this is something that pretty inspiring and something that we've sought to cover and show to our audience at Venezuela Analysis. So what I would like to see is perhaps a more frank debate in this perspective. You know, sanctions are not going away. How are we going to deal them in the most effective way? You know, we cannot, or the Venezuelan government cannot just continue, you know, to make these concessions in the hope that at some point they will be enough. But rather look at what are the most efficient ways to fight back against sanctions and to ensure the sovereignty and well-being of the Venezuelan people. And our perspective, our belief, which is reflecting what's being discussed in this grassroots movement and also by analysts that are close to us, is that the solution is there, right? It's not by trying to find this kind of consensus with the private sector, but rather giving a chance to the grassroots movements who have shown, like in the case of Pueblo Pueblo and other similar initiatives, how even in the most dire of circumstances, they are the ones who are prepared to, you know, step forward in a transparent way with political clarity to, you know, address short-term needs. So it's not like you need to do something now and support them now, and then in 15 years, there's going to be kind of a socialist alternative. No, these are things that are being built right now as we speak.
So if I had to sum up your answer, it kind of sounds like what you're calling for or what you would recommend is more socialism as opposed to less.
Yeah, and here I'm actually, you're quoting or I'm quoting our good friend Chris Gilbert, who wrote this in a recent article that, you know, because we always have this perspective. It's kind of how common sense gets constructed, that, you know, when you're in a crisis, you need to take a step back. And here, in this case, a step back means, you know, offering more concessions to the private sector and so on. And there's always there are familiar examples like the new economic policy under Lenin in the Soviet Union in the early 20s. And, you know, to some extent that's true. And I can accept, for example, you know, here there was a decree that determined that Venezuela state-owned company PDVSA had to hold 60% of shares in any joint venture. And in some cases that was reduced in the past five or six years, it was reduced to 51%. That's something I can perfectly live with. You know, it's a small incentive that you give to the foreign partner to, you know, make it work. But at the same time, there are always these very interested voices that say, oh, you know, sanctions only apply to companies where the Venezuelan state is the majority owner. You just change the legislation. But Venezuela becomes a minority owner in the oil sector, and all your problems go away. So that's the kind of thing where you have to draw a line somewhere. So that's in terms of the macro policy. And then, you know, when we go to the grassroots dynamics and all these examples that we've seen of how these organizations with limited resources but with a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of political clarity have found ways to solve issues. It's not to say that, you know, they hold a solution to everything, but it does show, or it does promise, that if they can continue to grow towards a larger scale, then not only do you address certain immediate needs of the Venezuelan population with solutions that kind of go away from the capitalist model, but you also become more immune to sanctions because there are things that are not affected by the kind of global international division of labor, capitalist dynamics, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, that actually brings me to my final question, which is that one of the things I found somewhat surprising, to be honest, is that from the government perspective, there's almost a defiant move that Venezuela will continue to deal with international partners and somehow still insert itself in the global capitalist market, as you say. What can explain this relaxed attitude by government officials, given the implications of what sanctions policy actually means for the population? How do we reconcile those views with those from the grassroots initiatives that have been critical of the accommodations that have been made to the interests of capital in the name of surviving this onslaught, and have instead been demanding that Venezuela build a new model that would overcome the imbalances and inequalities that are imposed on countries like Venezuela, global south countries, by capitalism, and instead move towards a more emancipatory horizon that you were describing?
Yeah, I think from the point of view of government spokespeople, they have to strike a tone where, on one hand, they sound defiant, like you said, you know, they cannot be cowed into retreating by the US, and so they have to at least show a brave face and claim that Venezuela is not going to be affected. But it will be affected for many reasons, and also, given what we knew in the past, you know, just go back to the 2019 oil embargo in January. So that eliminated the U.S. as a destination for Venezuelan oil. And then Venezuela wanted to, or, you know, quite clearly saw a good idea in trading with Indian energy corporations. And that was a very logical market and one with a very big need for oil, for crude. But then, you know, all the U.S. had to do was publicly threaten Indian corporations with secondary sanctions, and that was the end of it. That there was no way forward. We also know of the cases when Venezuela was forced to deal with these shady intermediaries to get oil to get crude to its final destinations, and that implies, you know, imposing discounts and also all the corruption that it breeds. You know, there's always corruption when it comes to capitalism. There's always been corruption in the Venezuelan oil industry. But if you're then forced to do these things in the shadows, there's even more of an incentive to do that. So on the one hand, I can understand that Venezuelan officials do not want to, you know, sound like they are predicting doom. But at the same time, this is something that our colleague Andreina Chavez wrote in one of her columns. You know, sanctions will be back at some point. The question is, are we more prepared to face them than we were last time around? I think the answer, you know, the short answer is yes. You know, there's been a modest economic growth in recent years. So I do believe that the country is better braced against these sanctions. But it doesn't mean that they won't still be devastating. And it kind of ties back to what I was saying in the beginning, you know, how sanctions end up imposing this kind of reduced sovereignty. So here, the clear case is Chevron. You know, Chevron has a special license. It can happily deal with Venezuelan oil. And now you start to hear rumors that Chevron might, you know, the joint ventures with Chevron. Chevron is still a minority partner. It's worth reminding. Then it's going to have its area expand or even absorb other ventures. So sanctions end up limiting Venezuela's prospects and improving Chevron's ability to profit from its Venezuelan operation. So here it ties back to what we were discussing about the grassroots perspectives and the grassroots examples. Just, you know, we're recording this on April 20, and tomorrow there's a national popular consultation across the country that will see people vote for projects that will be funded by the government, by the Venezuelan state. So, you know, when people listen to this, I recommend that they go back and look at our coverage. But it is a small example, but an example of how the grassroots movements can, you know, become sufficiently organized and fight back to get its share of the oil rent or state resources in a broader sense, and to then implement local projects that were voted for democratically. So the challenge going forward is, on one hand, to continue, you know, fighting to have some sort of protagonism in state policies, you know, not just be relegated while the government searches for some kind of stability with the private sector and foreign corporations on one hand, and on the other, continue to develop its own autonomy and economic muscle, so that, you know, in the long run, not only are they in better shape, but also the country is more prepared and more immune to these attacks that comes from the outside, because it kind of gets insulated if you start building these different kinds of social relations that are not immune to the logic of capital. And in the end, I mean, hopefully there will be some point in the not too distant future, we hope, where, you know, sanctions will be irrelevant because you have built something different.
Yeah, lately I've been thinking a lot about why we sometimes pretend like the U.S. is not going to behave the way it has always behaved historically. It is the imperialist power. It is the dominant state in the global capitalist order. It makes me think of the animal fable of the scorpion and the frog, right? Just why did it sting the frog? Because it's a scorpion. Why does U.S. imperialism refuse to acknowledge sovereignty? Because it's an imperialist power. And I think it's good for us to operate under this assumption, obviously working as far as we can within the confines of the international system, but really start thinking about what does South-South solidarity look like? What do grassroots initiatives, how do we need to stop pretending like the, you know, the scorpion isn't going to sting us. I want to thank you so much for being on the program with us, Ricardo. This is a really good chat as always. And be sure to follow our coverage, as you mentioned, of the upcoming referendum on April 21st, where grassroots initiatives will decide directly the priorities in certain regards of expenditures. Thanks, Ricardo.
Thanks, Jose Luis. It was a pleasure, and I look forward to the next time.
Los apellidos solicitaron nuevas sanciones de los gringos, y los gringos creen que pueden amenazar a Venezuela. No pueden amenazar a Venezuela.
In our next segment, we will speak with Pueblo a Pueblo spokesperson Laura Lorenzo, a longtime campesino activist and socialist organizer. Lorenzo speaks to us about the roots of this effort to organize food production, distribution, and consumption in Venezuela, the importance of seed sovereignty and agroecological practices, and what their experience can teach us about the potential of planned economies. It's no secret that Venezuela is going through a complex crisis amidst an imperialist siege, and initiatives like Pueblo a Pueblo represent an important trench of struggle. Tell us more. What is this initiative called Pueblo a Pueblo all about? And in your opinion, what are the lessons from experiences like this in the quest for solutions, but also in terms of defending a socialist horizon?
Pueblo a Pueblo, que inicia en febrero del 2015, con un objetivo en ese momento, la crisis económica que se establece en el país.
Pueblo a Pueblo was launched with a particular objective in February 2015. At that time, the economic crisis was unfolding in the country, and the aim was to distribute food directly from the producer, the campesino family, to organized families in the cities, the communal councils, communes, workers' councils, student councils, producing food not to hoard, not to generate profit, but producing based on need. Then in 2020, with the onset of the pandemic, permanent distribution centers were set up. Approximately 4.5 million kilos of fruits, vegetables, maize, meat, fish, etc., have been distributed according to the weekly, biweekly, or monthly needs of participating families. This has reached approximately more than 250,000 families. Currently, the project, through its connection with schools since 2018, is serving over 300 schools across 8 states, providing approximately 100,000 children and adolescents with fruits, vegetables, and greens as part of the school feeding program. Pueblo a Pueblo is a plan for the social organization of production, distribution, and planned consumption of food. It operates on a number of fundamental premises, such as cost-effective pricing, fair payment to producers, and continuous accompaniment with communities. This project has taught us that in addition to these fundamentals, the project must also have a clear objective. In our case, we're going to concentrate on promoting and integrating all aspects of food production, distribution, and consumption. Fostering sustainable agriculture based on the use of agroecological practices and seed production. We can't talk about food sovereignty or ensure the sustainability of our proposal if we don't produce seeds. Therefore, seed production must occur within communities to guarantee harvests. By that I mean those seeds must be in the hands of the people producing the food. We need to design and execute projects that incorporate sustainable agri-food systems. We should develop ongoing training programs in rural and urban communities to promote production processes within our communities. We must develop projects aimed at protecting the environment and counteracting the effects of climate change. In addition to our strategic objectives, we've learned in our journey that having principles in this case is also indispensable, because this is what allows the proposal to be sustainable over time. So, what are our principles? That food is not a commodity, it's a human right. That we must promote the social organization of production based on our right to feed ourselves. We must encourage sustainable consumption patterns, establish prices based on costs by the producing families, ensure timely payment to producers, continuous accompaniment with the people, and promote various forms of distribution based on voluntary work to bridge the gap between rural and urban areas from the outset. It has also been fundamental for us to have a methodology. This methodology, the Pueblo a Pueblo plan, is based on what we call a double participation ladder, where production is planned based on consumption needs, linking the countryside and the city. These processes are supported by a set of guidelines aimed at ensuring access to inputs. In rural areas, this would involve seed production and the production of bio-inputs, while in urban areas, it would involve promoting production processes within cities. It also involves changing consumption habits to make them healthier and more sustainable, incorporating a wide variety of crops that allow people to decide what they will eat every day. we also have work strategies. A very important lesson we've learned is that we advance faster building on the experience that people already have. So we define spaces, geographical productive spaces. That's why we divide the country into social bioregions, because when we're working in different territories, each with a wealth of varied experiences, both in terms of productivity, but also culturally, in the way things are done. We define these socio-regions based on various characteristics, not only climatic, but also cultural aspects. Likewise with consumers, because in every country in the world, people's preferences for consumption vary depending on their location. We also develop our work strategies by identifying already organized communities. We advance further where there are organized communities, whether in urban or productive areas. Of course, in both consumption and production in rural areas, planning is essential. Another work strategy involves promoting different distribution methods in various consumption spaces, always respecting how people feel most comfortable when distributing food. What does all of this facilitate? When we talk about defending that socialist horizon, it means that we are working with the people. We are not imposing, but building. As we build, we use those fundamental elements in the process of transformation through which our country is passing. There are many lessons that President Chavez left us when he spoke of that socialist Venezuela, where the means of production must be in the hands of the people. We have experienced this throughout all these years of economic warfare. If food is in the hands of capitalists, they try to use food as a weapon of war, and by doing that, they want to subdue us and impose conditions for us to access food. But if food is in the hands of the people, then we seek ways to produce and distribute so that food reaches the people. I believe that these are some of the fundamental lessons that this entire construction process behind Pueblo a Pueblo has left us. And from there, we build the basis for a truly socialist system from a political, economic, and social point of view.
Why do you put an emphasis on the use of sovereign seeds and agroecological practices, particularly in this current Venezuelan context?
We know that if we don't produce seeds, we'll always be dependent on other countries' production. As we've learned, when we bring seeds from other latitudes, other spaces, other cultures, there are always adaptation problems. But above all, we emphasize that if we talk about sovereign agriculture, sustainable agriculture, agroecological practices, agroecology, we must first discuss the topic of sovereign seeds. Seeds must be produced by peasant families according to their economic, social, and cultural situation in their planting spaces. Here we talk about socio-regions. In Venezuela, there are approximately 8 socio-regions with very particular characteristics, and it's necessary for the seed production process to adapt to the respective conditions of each of these territories. And of course, it's essential to establish spaces for seed exchange, for the sharing of experiences in terms of production. Since 2015, Venezuela has one of the most relevant applicable laws in the world on the matter, which is the Venezuelan Seed Law. This law respects the production of seeds by campesino, Afro-descendant, and indigenous people, providing a framework that protects these families who, by safeguarding seeds, have been responsible for maintaining these productive cycles for years. Seed banks for campesino, Afro-descendant, and indigenous seeds have been created, and during Venezuela's recent crisis, these seeds were responsible for ensuring food production in the country. It's often said that Venezuela doesn't produce food, but if you look closely, these territories remain productive because there's a seed passed down from generation to generation, safeguarded by the hands of our people, campesinos, indigenous peoples, and Afro-descendant people. Sovereign seeds are necessary for a country to be independent, sovereign. Independence lies in producing our own food. That's why we emphasize working on the production of sovereign seeds in the areas where the project is operating. With these practices, we can move beyond the destructive production model generated by green agriculture and agribusiness, which turned food into merely a business, and instead work within the framework of agroecological agriculture. Our work is always accompanied by political education in the spaces wherever the Pueblo a Pueblo plan is currently operating. That is, we accompany the people, we share with them, we guide them without imposing. We discover together that it's possible to carry out agroecological practices, that it's possible to cultivate in a healthier way, that it's possible for us to produce our own supply. Gradually, we are advancing in the transition from the destructive model of conventional agriculture to a healthier and more sustainable model, agriculture with agroecological practices.
A modelo más saludable, sustentable, que lo representa la agricultura agroecológica, la agricultura con prácticas agroecológicas.
Conservative voices in our countries often say, economic planning doesn't work. Tell us about your efforts to prove otherwise. What political educational impact does it have on the people to see the result of their efforts to produce to meet need and not just to generate profit?
Desde lo que ha sido la visión y la experiencia acumulada del plan Pueblo a Pueblo, todos estos 9 años, por los estados...
Based on the vision and accumulated experience of the Pueblo a Pueblo plan, throughout these 9 years in the states of Trujillo, Lara, Barinas, and Portuguesa, to name a few, we can say that two elements have been fundamental, planning and organization. They are fundamental for the development of the project itself. Without these elements, we would not have been able to achieve our current successes. When we arrived at the productive hubs in Trujillo, we learned with the people what planning was all about. It meant gathering weekly to first assess what needed to be produced. Based on this need, each family, each producer, each organization would discuss which crops we would work with. From there, cost structures were created. We understood that investment in inputs was necessary and that we could produce within the same spaces. Based on this planning, a projected price was established, ensuring transparent profits to continue the production process and, of course, to meet the family's primary needs. Naturally, during this period from 2014 to the present, it's been quite intense because of the fluctuations of the bolivar that have been quite strong as a result of what we've been experiencing in this economic war. Back in 2015, we looked at what had been planted, what had been spent, and then set the price. Even though every week we would review costs, these prices could remain stable for a semester. That is to say, they were only changed twice a year. This means that during the first 6 months, the same price was maintained for all the crops. However, as time progressed, there came a point, around 2020, when prices were discussed and changed throughout the entire week due to the strong impact of unforeseen changes in the national currency. But thanks to planning, this didn't have as negative an impact as it did in other productive areas, where they practically had to stop production. So, for us, economic planning has always been fundamental. To this day, we maintain the calculation of cost structures and crops based on need. This has allowed us to maintain all these production processes, despite the challenges faced by the Venezuelan countryside in recent years. For example, the scarcity of seeds led us to start producing our own seeds. When we plan, we consider all elements that could negatively influence what we're doing, so they're continually reviewed. If there's a problem, like with seeds, then we know we have to plan seed production. If there's a problem with costs, with the inputs or pesticides, people would then start looking into the production of biological inputs, all of which translated into lower costs. All of these factors, whether direct or indirect, influence production. So, you control these factors as you go along. In fact, some comrades later told us that people would come to offer them more for their harvest, but they would refuse. They would tell them, even if you buy it from me at double the price today, tomorrow you might buy it at a different price. So we prefer to stick to our plan and maintain prices until it's time to change them again as necessary. So I believe this effort benefits people because it allows them to keep producing and helps them control everything that could negatively impact their production system. From a political and educational standpoint, it's a learning experience. People grow accustomed. You go to these spaces and there's an established discipline. People know you have to gather regularly, whether it's every 8 days or every 15 days. There are connections, exchanges of experiences, discussions. There's a discipline created so that we can discuss the different crops being planted, evaluating if we have to decrease the planting of some, increase the planting of others. It's a beautiful process because it provides a learning experience. These learning elements stem from campesino knowledge. People shape the planning process based on their experience. Of course, we also want to make some profit because everyone needs to earn a living, but it's also satisfying to know that what we produce also benefits people. And something fundamental for us is the satisfaction people get from planning. From tomatoes, onions, peppers to potatoes, when the production process is complete and we go to harvest and distribute, the population knows that this food is going to schools or to a specific commune, a communal council, or another social organization. It has been very satisfying.
That's our program for today. For more on the issues explored, check out episode 21, The Global South Struggle for Climate Justice, episode 19, A War Without Bombs and Communal Resistance, and episode 18, Challenging the Bipartisan Imperialist Consensus on Venezuela. Be sure to visit us at VenezuelaAnalysis.com for regular news and analysis on all things Venezuela. We're also everywhere on social media. If you enjoy the program, please share it with your friends. We'll end today's episode with the song Campesino Amigo by Tiburcio.
Sentido el corazón de la tierra latir, tú que has escuchado a la tierra suspirar, donde el ruido de los carros no ensucian el trinar de un ave libre para volar, para vivir, tú que conversas con montañas de verdes trajes, sin tantos cementos que te dañan el paisaje, a ti que el árbol te da su fruto en tu propia mano, a ti que las flores pueden llamarte hermano. Que con paso de alpargatas a tu vuelo, que arrebata mil sonrisas al mismísimo cielo. Tú que cuyo sueño grande es sembrar la misma vida, con tus manos patria, en tus manos tierra querida. Campesino amigo, obrero del amanecer, que me invita a respirar, a soñar y a querer. A comer del fruto de tus amorosos pasos, junto a la Pachamama que temes en sus brazos.
Campesino amigo,
tú que amas a la tierra con un amor sin fin. Vivo en una ciudad heredera de Caín.
Campesino amigo,
tú que siembras y cosechas existencia, tú.
Tú que has cultivado la tierra.
Enséñame, que tengo tanto que aprender. Hey. Lucha tierra, tierra y agua, agua y pan, la siembra, la idea, el café tempranero, la conciencia, la semilla, la verde esperanza del camino. Campesino amigo, obrero de mismísimo Dios divino, con machete en mano y la frente bien en alto, lejos tan lejos de la selva de asfalto, que con trabajo y sudor solo siembras amor y cosechas amor, más allá de un patrón explotador, lejos de ciudades causantes de tantos males, entre humo de automóviles y luces artificiales, campo que ya no es campo, naturaleza rota, rota ilusión tras otra, trozo de planeta que explota. Tú que vives por el pan de cada día, lucha tierra, tierra y agua, agua y pan, la poesía. Campesino amigo, tú que has cultivado la tierra, dime cuánto amor le siembra para retratar su belleza.
Campesino.